This is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Yeah, welcome to the Christian War Room. And we are just looking at an aspect as well. We've spent a lot of time on this, but one of the things which I kind of see in society is that this has become stronger. Again, 30 years ago, I would have never thought that this was an issue or would ever become an issue. And it seems to be the case. There's a lot of weird stuff out there in the world. And again, as Christians, we need to deal with that, because there's more likeliness that in your life, within the church, or you know, as a Christian, you're likely to be confronted with this issue. Personally, for me, it's happened twice in my career that I've I've met with people who have decided to transgender and to go from one to the other. And it's a big question. How do we deal with that? You know, from a Christian perspective, we obviously, you know, deal with them in a loving and caring way. From a political point of view, or from a, you know, what should we tell our congregation on how to deal with this? What does the Bible say? Obviously, it's a big no-no. The Bible has got a very, very clear concept of, you know, masculinity and femininity, of what it means to be a man and what it means to be a woman. And what is the world, what the world is telling us is very different. It's almost on opposing terms, you know, contradictory terms to what the Bible says. Obviously, we need to stick with the Bible. I found some very interesting information some time ago, and I just want to share this. And I was listening to this on a talk, and there, you know, people who desire to, you know, change their sex or to cross-dress, there's a drug they can take, and I'm just gonna go to it. The drug is called Pimozite, or Pimozite. I'm just gonna spell it out for you. It's Pimozide, and it's been from an article from 1996. So that's quite a long time ago, but really nobody talks about this. And it would just be, you know, a walk to the pharmacy and, you know, people take this drug and the problem is over. You know, the desires don't exist anymore. There's a theory that some of it is down to an hormonal imbalance in the body, and that people therefore have got sort of weird ideas or strange ideas. Okay, I'm just going to read it out to you. The website is, again, it's on radio, so, but you can go to christianwarroom.com to listen to this talk again. I'm just going to give you the URL. I'm going to spell out each letter. So it's www.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov/pubmed/883-9957. Okay, let me just repeat this. It's www.ncbi.nlm.nih.gov. And then /PubMed. So it's PubMed/883-9957. Okay, so that's the that's the URL if you want to go to it. So just go to, I know you can't write it down whenever you're listening via the radio, but go to christianwarroom.com and you can listen to it again, you know, stop the truck and then just get the information out there, extract the information. It says here, successful treatment of a gender dysphoric patient with Pimozite. Yeah. And the abstract is objective. The case is a reporter of a gender dysphoric patient who responded successfully to pharmacotherapy with Pimozite. A clinical picture, the adult male patient with a borderline learning disability presented with cross-dressing and a strong wish to undergo sex change treatment. Supportive psychotherapy and pharmacotherapy with Pimozite was tried. Outcome, There was an excellent response to Pimazoid, 2 milligrams daily, with the cessation of both cross-dressing and wish for sex reassignment. When after 1 year the dose was reduced to 1 milligram daily, there was a rapid return to cross-dressing and wish for sex reassignment. An increase in the dose again led to a remission, which has been maintained since then. Pharmacotherapy with Pimazoid should be considered in cases of doubtful gender dysphoria. Very interesting. So you just give a little bit of medicine and problem is over. You know, people are fine. They can carry on with their lives and have relative normality. That's the article. We are now looking at the fraud of gender reassignment medicine. This is a talk by... Let me just get it back up again. Difficult Latin terms. Endocrinologists. I hope I got this right. And he is a fellow of the American College of Pediatricians and the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists. And he himself is obviously working in this field, has been working in this field for many years. His name is Quentin Van Meter. And very interesting talk. We started him off yesterday on the first half of his talk. And today is going to be the second half of his talk. You can check this out on christianwarroom.com. And just go to talk number 127 for the current talk and talk number 126 for the previous talk. Okay, let's move over to Dr. Meter.
And you say, well, what did that have to do with anything? Well, it looks scientific. It's got a Journal of Hormone Research. That's a really respectable journal. Look at that reference. That's a really powerful one. When it has very little to do with anything in the actual subject matter. So you can make yourself a 270-item bibliography that looks really powerful. And if you look at a lot of what's done, it's a cut and paste. You can tell that the same articles are referenced when they do write their articles. And so it's a very poor science. They also have created, the WPATH has created its own Journal of Transgender Health. Now, this is supposed to be a peer-reviewed journal, okay? If you imagine that everyone who reviews it is a member of WPATH or believes in that, can you imagine the quality of the articles that you're going to find? Well, anything in terms of contradiction to a transgender-affirming concept be approved or published? Absolutely not. So they have a medical society, so-called, and their own journal, and that gives them credibility. These things make a huge difference in the medical community. For my colleagues who are not in my subspecialty, they are totally dependent on this kind of appearance, thinking, wow, there's an international group that has its own peer-reviewed journal, and they say transgender issues need to be affirmed, and we need to do hormone treatment, we need to do surgical treatment, and the sooner the better. This gives steam to the engine. If you wonder why we've gone from 0 to 60, it's because this kind of stuff is sweeping over the medical community, and the vast majority of my pediatric colleagues think it's absolutely total valid science. They have no idea what's behind the curtain. The other interesting thing is that their bibliography at WPATH now completely is devoid of any reference to Dr. Kenneth Zucker, who was the pioneer in gender identity disorder. His name has been expunged as if he's never existed. So they're on the rampage. They have standards of care that they developed for transgender health. They lobby the American Psychological Association to change gender identity disorder into gender dysphoria. The reason that they even kept it in as some kind of disorder was because they realized the poor transgender patients were not going to be able to get any health care paid for if they didn't have a pathologic diagnosis. So they changed the diagnosis from a disorder, a delusional state, to the pain and agony and suffering caused by society for these poor, otherwise normal transgender variant patients. So it legitimizes transgender as a normal variant. It blames society for all of the agony that these patients, and it facilitates insurance coverage for these patients for the treatment of their dysphoria. And as I said, they removed all references to Dr. Zucker in their, and they convinced the Canadian government to actually shut down Dr. Zucker's clinic after all of his 35 plus years and almost 600 patients that he treated successfully. They pulled the plug and let him go. He no longer has a clinic to go to in Canada, in Toronto, where he was. That's the power of this organization. Meanwhile, back here in the United States, Dr. Spack coalesced a group of individuals from around the world, including the clinics in the Netherlands and in Sweden and in the United States, and they put together a set of guidelines. The committee excluded anybody with a contrary opinion. So Dr. Zucker, who is the pioneer, essentially, in this country and this continent, with transgender medicine, was not included to discuss or create the guidelines that the Endocrine Society in the United States, professional organization, was going to adopt. He was left out. Dr. Paul McHugh, who had written extensively from Johns Hopkins, and who previously had been what was called a preeminent, world-renowned clinician, he was left out as well. So in 2009, they put together the guidelines. They did send out a little notice saying, if you're interested in reviewing them, have any comments, please, you know, please let us know. And at that particular time, I wasn't paying attention. I was a member of the Endocrine Society, but I didn't bother to turn in any comments. I just kind of went by the by. And lo and behold, this comes out in the Endocrine Throwaway Journal. It is the transsexual treatment guidelines. And they outlined those in this particular journal, but it was published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. So the guidelines in the nutshell are, do a psychological assessment. It doesn't tell you how deep. Just say, hey, you know, are you troubled? Check mark, okay? That's all we do. We want to affirm and transition any child who states they are born into the wrong body. We want to block puberty as it begins. At age 16, we want to consider putting them on cross-sex hormones. At age 18, if the patient desires, they can sign on with informed consent for corrective surgery, so-called corrective surgery. Of the 22 guidelines, only three meet any degree of scientific validity, according to a standard scale used to create these guidelines. It's used sort of internationally. Of those three, those were all about concerns about the puberty-blocking hormones and the cross-sex hormones and what would happen to these patients medically that could be adverse, okay? The remainder of them were based on very little science or absolutely no science whatsoever, and yet the guidelines were published. So the revised guidelines have just been put out by the Endocrine Society. They felt they needed to be updated because of the sudden push in transgender health issues. They added additional concerns about the fact that these patients might have issues with fertility that they should be told about. Now, you're talking to a 12-year-old child about their infertility, lifelong infertility, and cancer risk from cross-sex hormones, and you expect that child to grasp that and understand that and assent to going on the hormones, or have the parents take the responsibility for that. Are you kidding? Are you absolutely kidding? There is no other area in medicine except for chemotherapies for death-causing cancers where that would even be considered as an option, and we're not talking about death-causing cancers here. They suggested earlier cross-sex hormone therapy than waiting till 16, suggested earlier top surgery, that is to say mastectomies in girls, should be done before age of consent. And once again, they lacked reasonable scientific evidence in all but four recommendations. They removed all references in these guidelines to Zucker, whereas before they'd had them in there. These are the articles you heard about, the New Atlantis article that Paul McHugh and his colleague, Dr. Mayer, put together. This was a beautifully written, extensively referenced article that had to be published in the New Atlantis magazine, primarily because no other reputable journal would print it because it wasn't politically correct. On the right side, you see the article written by Dr. Kenneth Zucker before his clinic was shuttered, showing the absolutely essential guidelines for treatment of transgendered persons. Not to be left out in terms of guidelines is the Pediatric Endocrine Society, which is a separate organization, decided they wanted to go through and create their own guidelines. For the 2017 guidelines and for these guidelines, I made sure I gave them input. Not a shred of what I said was ever answered or respected in terms of how the guidelines came out. Not that I'm an important person, but they did ask for input. I gave it, and it was as if I was never, I never existed. The guidelines are emphatically restating the Endocrine Society guidelines and suggest that all the treatment should be covered by insurance, and that was the most important thing. Now, you hear over and over again, the American College of Pediatricians is a tiny racist, bigoted, homophobic group from the South. They're all religious zealots, okay? And they are on the hate list of the Southern Poverty Law Center, proud to say, okay? And that makes us feel really good because there's a lot of good company on that list of very decent human beings. But the American Academy of Pediatrics, whose membership is now upwards of 65,000 members of pediatricians and pediatric healthcare providers otherwise, endorses affirmation of transgender and treatment as guidelines of endocrine society say. How in the world can 66,000 pediatricians fall behind something that is so absolutely out of control? Why did the American Psychological Association take out gender identity and make it gender dysphoria? Don't these thousands and thousands and thousands of professional individuals understand that there should be some kind of balance, and there should be a little give and take, and perhaps two opinions stated, or at least admit that there's another opinion that should be considered? How it happens is that the general membership is allowed to have special interest groups. And the special interest groups are a tiny fraction of the membership, and they have a bee in their bonnet. They have a cause that they want to go for. Then that special interest group interacts with the executive committee that governs all of the decisions of policies made for the huge membership. In the American Academy of Pediatrics, that executive committee is 15 people. Membership, 66,000. So those 15 people listen to the special interest group, and all of a sudden, it's adopted by the entire society as if 66,000 people agree. And that's published. The American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Psychological Association, the American Association of Family Practitioners, the Endocrine Society all agree. And they're professional societies. And by God, the medical world totally supports this. And you fanatic, crazy Southern religious bigots are a small splinter group, and we shouldn't listen to you. We get that argument all the time. So, as this is like a domino, the APA, American Psychological Association, publishes something, the American Academy of Pediatrics jumps on board, and then the Endocrine Society jumps on board, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Suddenly, the medical professionals are all in favor of Obamacare. The medical professions are all in favor of transgender transitioning. And in truth, the physicians who work their bones to death every single day and take care of patients where the rubber hits the road have no idea what's going on at the level down where the rubber hits the road. So it was alluded to by David Pickup this morning that why in the world is this transgender thing being pushed by the LGB community? When did they add T, and why did they do that? Well, as he pointed out, if you get transgenderism as born that way and a civil rights in terms of being transgender are protected, then male and female go away and the whole issue of acceptance of same-sex attraction all of a sudden is moot. It makes no difference if there is no sex one way or the other. So what does the T stand for? It's interesting historically. Originally it was transsexual, then it became transgender. Maybe you can throw transvestite in there as well, as if that is, and it's been blended together by LGBT. They are almost as if everybody that's in the trans community is all the same, which of course is absolutely hogwash and nonsense. Transvestite can be heterosexual males who just absolutely love getting dressed up and putting on nail polish and high heel boots and kinky boots, okay? Or they can be like drag queens, which it's a profession that are not necessarily, they can be homosexual, but many times they are not. The famous one being RuPaul, who says, "You can call me anything you want to. I know who I am." Okay? And he refers to himself as he all the time. But he is brought into the trans group as if he is actually transgender, when the case is absolutely untrue. The advantage of inclusions in this alphabet soup of LGBT are anchoring transgender as civil rights, attempting to legitimize born that way, and the wider audience on the internet, which is a huge recruitment tool. The U.S. landscape in 1970, transsexual clinic at Hopkins was established, and in 1984 it was closed. In 2006, Norm Spack opened up his Boston clinic. 2009, Endocrine Society guidelines were published. And since then, we're upwards of 50 transgender clinics nationwide. So originally, it's like mushrooms sprouting. The map that had just Boston on it, you see all these mushrooms growing here. There are clinics all over the place, all with experts at the helm, so-called, none of whom have ever been really trained in transgender medicine. The battle to return to science is important. Only gender-affirming experts are invited to speak at academic meetings so that the alternative opinion cannot be heard. I attempted to do a balanced presentation in a meeting in Houston Austin, that was held last year for the Endocrine Society, the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology, AACE. And we wanted to have a balanced presentation. What was presented was just the transgender affirming side, and no one else was invited. The publication after that meeting was describing how forward-thinking the organization was because they had embraced this new trend that was new science and needed to be paid attention to. No mention of counter ideas. The counseling to return to natal sex identity is outlawed in some states. You cannot do that. Your license will be taken away and you could be jailed. LGBT activists seek to destroy the opposition through academic influence. Dr. Mark Regnerus, who wrote the paper on issues with kids raised in same-sex families, was removed from his faculty position temporarily. The university ended up having to reinstate him. But his journal article was pulled temporarily, and then when it was reviewed and found to be valid, it was reinstated as an article that did not need to be rescinded. There are many people in academic medicine who keep their mouths shut because their jobs depend on not opening their mouth. If they feel strongly about transgender issues and do not want to affirm patients with therapy, they just lay quiet for fear that if they're not tenured, they're going to be fired. So the major medical journals refuse to publish anything. The ones that we all, New England Journal of Medicine, Journal of American Medical Association, the Journal of Pediatrics, JCENM in the endocrine world will not publish anything that is counter to the gender-affirming concept. So that's why Dr. McHugh had to publish in the Atlantis Journal, because it was a beautifully written article that was polished and would have done beautifully in terms of review. It just wasn't politically correct. So that they forced them to the margin. And then they're doing research providing benefits through affirmation using a different kind of standard for clinical research. There are ethical guidelines for clinical research that you have to agree to before you do a clinical study. First of all, there must be informed consent. Every aspect of what you're doing as a proposed treatment must be explained, the good, the bad, and the ugly, okay? Not so in gender identity research stuff. Clear assessment of benefits versus harm. The harm, so-called, in not affirming is that the patient has a high risk of suicide. The problem is the high risk of suicide exists anyway. It's not made any worse. Absence of bias, presented as you need to have a balanced approach where you do review those indications that are counter to your proposal, bring them up in your proposal, and deal with them and show that your hypothesis might disprove them, but they will be included as a concept. None of that is being done in the transgender research that's currently going on. Independence of safety by an institutional review board with stopping criteria at the very first sign of any adverse effect that affects the patient. So here we have cases already of adults whose lives have been totally tragically ruined, committing suicide or standing up finally and opening up and writing books about how horrible their lives have been in this new transition state. That would be a stopping criteria for the study before it ever got started, but all of that is completely ignored. There's currently funded an NIH study with 4 centers in the United States. They're recruiting kids who are 5 years of age and older, and they are going to affirm these children in all ways, and at the end of 5 years, they're going to find out if they're happy or not. The problem is there's no control group. They didn't choose 40 kids or 80 kids and divide them into 2 groups randomly and say, we're going to affirm you, and then we're going to use the other non-affirming criteria and psychotherapy and see what happens at the end of 5 years in terms of levels of happiness. There is no control group. That would not pass muster in any scientific venture anywhere else. And the evaluation of how successful you are is by asking the parents and the researchers how they have assessed happiness. Again, no independent evaluation of that at all. It's totally biased. It's going to essentially stop puberty, and we're going to have a group of kids moving forward that are treated by something that is an experiment for which they already are going to get the answer they know they wanted. So the details of this study, you cannot find them on the NIH website. It's totally non-existent. You just have to know the study exists by reading about the claims that the study is starting and where they recruited patients from. So there's fallout in the local community. School boards are railroading through regulations without public hearings. It's happened here in Texas. It's happening in Decatur, Georgia at this point in the Atlanta area. Large corporations are threatening to pull out of municipalities because of thoughts of if you don't accept transgender rights, we're not going to do business with you and your community will fail. And then gender centers of excellence are actively treating patients from age 3 and up with affirming therapies, cross-sex hormones after puberty blockers, in advance of the data showing that it is at all safe or effective. It's already happening. So what can we do to turn back the tide against it? We can always begin with a statement that truly shows that we are compassionate about these children. We do not hate transgender patients. We do not treat them poorly when they come to our offices. We are compassionate. We go to the root of the problem. We find the therapist, such as David, who will go back and look at the family structure and figure out the roots of the reason why this child feels they are in the wrong body. We will stand firm with our scientifically based convictions. We invite dialogue with the other side instead of just throwing bombs over the fence the way they do at us. We've invited them numerous times. They will not answer the invitation. And we join with broad-based group of diverse backgrounds. We have in our side lesbian activist groups who are totally and thoroughly disgusted with the concept of raising a child and affirming the wrong gender. Sounds like crazy. We're suddenly in partner with radical feminists. But they feel that this, there's no science behind what's being done, and they want to stop it as well. And then we never are afraid to discuss how our faith helps us in our decision making. And as scientists, one of the things I remember from my fellowship days is arguing with a fellow from Israel who was in training, and he said to me, "You know, Kventin, the more we know about science, the more we know there is no God." And I looked right back at him, I said, "Zvi, funny, but the more I know about science, the more I know there is God." So we encourage the victims of drug and surgical therapy to speak out. Renee Jax has written this book, Don't Get on the Plane. If you look carefully, it's a Trans World Airlines plane from back in the day. Very clever. It's high time that we point out that the emperor is naked. Thank you.
Yeah, you're listening to the Christian Ballroom, and thanks for tuning in. Interesting talk by Dr. Mita. You can check it out on christianballroom.com. Talk number 1-7 and 1-6, so both of them, the first one was 1-6, but goes more into the history, and then obviously this one, you've just listened to it. Okay, serious issue we are dealing with in our generation, and obviously people as well who are dealing with these problems. Serious. I mentioned before that the suicide attempts is 40% of the people. That's statistical data who go through this transition. They end up trying to commit suicide. Compared to the normal population, is about 20 times higher. The suicide rate of successful suicide. So, again, as a church, we are called to really reach out to these people. The world has encouraged them to do this crazy stuff and to go to something which is very unnatural, and the world has failed them at the same time. So as a church, we need to be there for these guys, and we need to, you know, invite them in. Tell them about the truth. Don't hesitate about the truth. Tell them the way of God, and help them in whatever stage they are in their lives. Very, very difficult, and obviously lead them to the gospel, lead them to salvation and repentance. You're listening to the Christian War Room. Thank you for tuning in, and it's great to have you here. God bless.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to christianwarroom.com. That's christianwarroom.com.